Imagine you want to get the backstory from the chef or the owner of your favorite hole-in-the-wall restaurant. How would you do that? What would you ask? What would you try if they let you? My guest today has made a job of finding out the backstory at those hole-in-the-wall places. Stay tuned for a fun and peppered discussion of life in the restaurant business. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 178.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. If you cook or grill or smoke food, you need to know when it's done. Check out the number one chef-rated digital thermometer at culinarylibertarian.com/cheftemp. Rashawn Parker is my guest today, and he wears many hats, including filmmaker and host and narrator and producer of his own show, Beyond the Check. He'll explain more about that soon. Rashawn has serving experience, and that means he has a restaurant vocabulary, seasoned to perfection with some colorful metaphors, so to speak. I've left them in, and this is just to say that they are there. If you've watched the Christmas classic Die Hard, you may not even notice them. All right, enough of that. Let's get into the show.
Hello. Hello, Rashawn. Thank you for joining
us. Hi, Dan.
On the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
How are we doing?
I'm except for getting my time zones all confused, I'm fine. It's midday here, it's afternoon there. Who cares?
We're both here.
Yes, indeed.
And whatever time this is.
We're in now. The Eckhart Tolle thing. So before we get into this, interesting conversation about what you do, give us a little bit of a basic about what you do.
So currently, I find chef-owned and operated restaurants, drag my crew and my wife to them to find out about their lives, the history of the restaurant, and of course, have them cook up and let me try some of the best dishes they have to offer.
Well, of course, that part.
So, on a wonderful show called Beyond the Check Worker Owner Edition on Amazon Prime and Tubi TV.
I followed the link. You sent me one to the episode with, as it happens, in Athens, Ohio. Purple Chopsticks.
My sister's restaurant.
Yes. Well, I was going to let you say that part. Fun. So it has a, the show has, and maybe from the first episode, as you're learning your craft and you're learning and your skills at your craft are growing, I like the feel of, it's just like you talking to me. I don't want this to sound like it's a negative, that it isn't highly polished. I think that's a feature, that it's just you and your car going to a place talking about what you're going to do. I think there's there's an appeal to that. So, why start the show? What was the thing that got you to say, you know what, we need to do the show?
So I did several, I mean, I've made several other things. You know, I had a feature film called Odie based in Odyssey by Homer. I made a couple pilots for just random things. I did the original Beyond the Check was actually, I would go pick up servers or bartenders or somebody in the service industry, basically like my podcast. But then I'd take them to do something fun and we'd talk about work, because what do servers and restaurant people like to do when they get off work, even though they say they're not going to do it? Talk about work. So I figured that would be good, but it was more YouTube-y and not, you know, it was more of a podcast than anything else. And I was like, I need to go to restaurants. And so my father had passed away, actually, and we were in Ohio for a celebration of life party, and my sister and her husband own Purple Chopsticks. So I was just like, hey, while I'm here, do you mind if I, like, you know, shoot a little expose on you guys? Like, I didn't even really know the format or really what I was doing. I just knew I was going to, like, you know, make this restaurant pilot thing. And Jordan was super excited to do that. If you can't tell from the first episode, she was very happy to be in that car and to be on camera.
She looked overwhelmed with pleasure.
And as the seasons go on, she's looking slightly happier.
Well, that's good.
By the time season three comes out, she's cooking with the chefs and, like, actually, like, more of a part of the show.
Well, good. So in case the listener couldn't tell, Sean's wife looked less than thrilled throughout the entire first episode. So that she's getting into it is a good thing.
She's super picky. So she, part of my, I guess, torturous, like, idea behind it was that I wanted to make her, like, eat food that she wouldn't normally eat. Because she won't just do it if I ask her to, but I thought maybe if she's, like, drugged to restaurants and, you know, cooked, you know, food from, like, fantastic chefs, that maybe she'd at least give it a try. And she does. It's in her contract. She has to take one bite of everything.
Well, so you and I come from a food background, and it's a weird thing. I've known cooks and I've known chefs who, I mean, everybody has their own preferences and a certain thing. So most chefs like most things, or at least they'll taste most things because that's part of the job. And we all have things we just don't want to eat. I knew a guy who absolutely hated and refused to eat cilantro. Well, I know. So, you know, there's that 25% of people taste like soap thing, but
yeah, I don't like cilantro.
When you're the chef of the restaurant,
you got to try it.
You kind of need to do that because you need to make sure that the food that people are making is right. So I understand having a picky, but I also understand, like, it's just, you know, this is the food show, so you got to eat it. So there's that. That's a funny thing.
I've taken her to a hamburger place. I give her what she wants on occasion. You know, I took her to a sushi place or a pokey shop, and she had them try multiple, like, raw tuna things, but they also had a filet bowl. So she was happy with that.
I bet.
I don't torture her perpetually. I just, you know, it's just helping her expand her palate.
All right. So tell me a little bit about your cooking background.
I'm not a chef.
Okay.
Not a chef.
Line cook, front of the house.
Front of the house, manager, bartender, server. I mean, I've been a prep cook. I've been a dishwasher.
Everyone's been a dishwasher.
I'm a home cook. I cook at home.
Right.
But, you know, I spent, you know, 20 years in the service industry around plenty of chefs. And, you know, they're my friends and they come over and cook. And, like, so I just, you know, I can cook, but I would never want to do it professionally. That seems awful.
Well, I want to get into part of that. So there, and as it happened, so I've done the whole gamut, but focused heavily on fine dining, and some of the servers, I'm telling you, I mean, they maybe wouldn't have been able to handle. It wasn't that the quality of the food wasn't there. These guys could cook. It was there's a pace. there's a speed. There's an urgency that's not really everybody's game. But some of servers who, spectacular, amazing cooks.
I mean, you have to admire, like, a Texas Roadhouse grill.
Yeah.
Right? Because I can be highly organized and I can take, you know, I can wait on, you know, 15 tables at the same time and try not to forget a straw. But like trying to, you know, you got orders coming in like a banshee with just different steak temperatures and trying to nail something you can't see. You know, in a highly organized manner, like to know which one to flip when to get it. I mean, that's insane. That it hurts my head to even try to think about it. So, like, I thoroughly admire those guys because that shit's nuts. And people complain, oh, you fucked up my steak. Well, yeah, well, I mean, dude, the guy, I mean, he's got to make a mistake every once in a while because that shit ain't easy.
Nope, it's a challenge. So you answered one of the questions I was going to ask was, is there a season three? And there is a season three.
Texas.
Good deal. I know people in Texas. We'll see if you get there. Actually, I know.
It's already shot, actually. We're back.
Oh, okay.
We went to Dallas. We went to Dallas and Austin and Bryan, Texas. So, like, the outskirts of Dallas, the outskirts of Austin.
Well, this place is well outside of Dallas. It's 4 hours, so probably wouldn't have gone there.
Pretty far.
So now we're in three seasons.
It'll be out in November. Season three will be out in November.
Very good. We'll look for that. What has surprised you the most?
Generally speaking?
Either that or if there's something that really stands out to you, like from episode to episode, or this one thing keeps coming up, or just in general, what has surprised you in making the show?
I don't know that it's really surprised me, but it's you do end up with, you know, kind of a lot of the same, like, COVID stories, right? Like, community rallying around people.
Right.
Just, you know, because a lot of restaurants didn't make it, haven't made it, and particularly in certain states, they did worse than in other states. And there's just restaurants that aren't coming back. And fortunately, everywhere that I've been, though the show's only taken place in Savannah, South Carolina, and now Texas. So Georgia, South Carolina, and Texas, is that those restaurants in those states, for the most part, are all still there, that they were able to open, that they were able to, you know, continue functioning and making money and paying their rent. Right. Even if they barely were able to pull it off, they did pull it off. And so I literally, like, thinking about trying to go to other states, like, hey, come to California. Hey, come to Michigan, you know, and it's just, well, they're gone. The restaurants aren't there. And even, you know, like in New York, where those restaurants have been completely wiped out because there was an overabundance of restaurants in, like, New York City. They're just opening, and now they're all gone. And so now you have this, what I think is kind of described as, like, the coming out of the ashes. Right. So the new restaurants that are opening now after the other ones have been shut down, and the people who have the money to open a restaurant now post COVID in those large cities. I think the entire scene has changed around those areas. Right. So it used to just be tons of places where you go. Now it's a much smaller choice. And I'm curious about the financials that went into the places that have taken over since most places are gone. Seems messed up.
Well, I think the
shocking difference across the country, I think, is in the ability to allow the service industry to survive is mind-boggling. That's the most shocking thing. It's just the major difference in areas,
right,
and the effect that it had on them is night and day across the country.
In the pilot with Purple Chopsticks, I think it was your sister was commenting that there were people in the community that were coming to support the restaurant and people she'd never seen. Now, I don't know. I've never been to Athens, Ohio. I don't know really how big it is. I know it's a college town, but that doesn't really reveal very much because it doesn't have to be a big place to be a college town, but there it seems like, and maybe I'm taking this too far, that what you're finding is a new sense of community in an actual community area of several blocks. It's what sure. It sounded like she was saying happened in Athens with the Chopsticks.
Well, I mean, that was pre-COVID. So that was just, I think she moved to a new neighborhood and so met her neighbors. And so there's people that just, because that restaurant's been there for 30 years. And it's amazing to think that in Athens is a very small town, that in 30 years, there'd be any adult that wouldn't know
right. What
it is, you know, because I mean, the population besides the college students is very, very small.
What else happens in Athens? Is it Nothing.
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Without the college, there would be a couple bars and a grocery store.
Yeah, like every other town. Grocery store. Well, that's a step up. Not everybody.
Not even a Walmart. Just like a random,
right?
Random independent grocery store.
From now, this isn't really a trick question, but it kind of sounds like it is. What has changed in 20 years in the restaurant business? And obviously, some parts haven't changed at all. People sit down, other people bring you the food, but there has to be something.
Well, there's no smoking sections anymore.
I remember those.
I think the quality of food that the consumer requires has changed more than anything in the last 20 years. I mean, 20 years ago, Applebee's was like the shit, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, oh my God, we're getting Applebee's in our town. Woo, right?
I think there was I think Bennigan's is gone, but Bennigan's, Applebee's, Chili's, Fridays, to me, it was just one restaurant with four names. It was all the same stuff.
Right, but it wasn't, they were still looked upon as actual food, you know, as opposed to like, you know, McDonald's. But now I think people drive across the country and they look out on the highway and they see the Applebee's, they see the McDonald's, and they see, you know, the Waffle House, and it just all looks like trash food. From your general, more educated consumer, is just like, no, like, oh, no. I guess if we're on vacation, sure, we'll stop and eat at the Shoney's if you have to. But for the most part, if you're home, you're not gonna go out to a corporate restaurant on a date. I mean, unless you're in a country song.
I gotta tell you, out here, I kind of miss Waffle House.
Oh, don't.
They're not everywhere.
They're not. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, there's.
I'm not sorry because your stomach thanks you, your ass thanks you.
And, some things weren't great there, but the smothered and covered hash browns, that was a good thing.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a good filling drunk food. It's satisfying, but it'll ruin you the next day. Nobody goes to Waffle House sober. Okay, like no one's you know where I want to go for breakfast first thing in the morning after like. Being super healthy and like not drinking all night, it's probably not Waffle House. It's like pizza, right? Like, so there's those late night pizzas, right? That like are so good when you're drunk, greasy, just like doughy. but if you try to eat that shit for lunch and like from your lunch break, from the office, no, the pizza is terrible. So a good way to describe a good pizza place is to just say, oh, it's even good when you're sober. Because
that's a good thing. You should market that tagline.
The pizza's still good.
You'll eat it when you're sober. I like it.
It's still good.
It's funny. All right. So you brought up the COVID thing. And so I really want to get into, since you have the comparison from the Purple Chopsticks pre-COVID to now three seasons, getting into through the, we'll call it the pandemic. How is there, this is really an unfair question. Is there a single thing that most restaurants experienced or several things that just was sort of
the thing
industry broad? Or?
I think the one thing that kept a restaurant going, the ones that survived, even in the smaller towns where most of them did survive or in the, you know, more lenient states, was that they had the ability to, you know, flip the way they did business, right? From restaurants that did zero takeout, had no takeout programs at all, to now have amazing elaborate online presences with, you know, easy online ordering and like just taking what used to be just this sit down, you know, thing and expanding it and understanding that the internet is your friend, understanding that, that takeout is now a large part of their businesses, even post COVID, right? Restaurants that had zero takeout now are doing still like large percentages of their business via carryout because they now have the infrastructure around the ability to online order and to simplify the process of getting their food. And I think that was a major factor, and the ones that succeeded was the ability to pivot and actually, you know, control their profit to be able to still have customers, to be able to still sell their food, was the major difference in the ones that survived and the ones that didn't.
You think services like DoorDash and Uber Eats had a significant part to play in restaurants staying alive?
For sure. But even just the ability to, you know, walk, you know, just bringing the food out to the car.
Right.
You know, benefits the restaurant better than a DoorDash because, you know, they're all just raping the restaurants like hand over fist. But when you need even that small profit margin during tough times, yeah, they definitely aided. But I don't know that they're necessary for the long run. I think it'd honestly be cheaper just to hire your own delivery driver. It will cost you less money than paying the fees.
There's a couple of places here in my town that do that. There's a pizza joint that has their own cars and their own drivers, and I can't recall the name of it, but there's another place that has their own drivers, and they just go and deliver to you if you can't get to them.
Yeah, I ordered Chinese food the other night. And this is fun. So weirdly, Savannah doesn't have a lot. Most places, the two things you can order to go before DoorDash and everything was pizza and Chinese, right?
Sure.
Savannah weirdly doesn't have a lot of delivery Chinese, but I found like the number one rated Chinese place, and it's a hole in the wall. Turns out they deliver, and I was like, oh sweet, I'm gonna order Chinese food, and I ordered and. She called me when she got here and she was like, hey, can you come outside and like, you know, come pick it up from the car? And I'm like, yeah, sure. No problem. And I go out to get the Chinese food and she's down the street a little bit. She's not even in front of my house. I'm like, hey, down here, come on. And she pulls up and she hands me my food and I give her cash and I'm like, no, keep it, whatever. And she's like, oh, thank you. And her phone rings and she's like, oh, hello, you know, China too, whatever. And she's like, oh yeah, what would you like? So she's literally the owner. She's taking an order while she delivers me the food, right? And she's like, oh, yeah, 30 minutes, no problem. And I'm like, and she pulls away. So I can only assume that, like, probably her husband was back at the restaurant making the food. He doesn't really speak English, so he's not answering the phone. She's answering the phone while she's driving and delivering and then texting him the orders so that he can make them. So by the time she gets back, they're ready and she can go back out and deliver.
Wow.
Right? And that's, I was so proud, happy of that for her.
That's cool. That's a good story. That's a good story.
So, like, you don't need DoorDash. You know, get a dishwasher who has a decent driving record and send them out when it's time for deliveries, you know?
Right. What have you seen as far as, well, it's a complicated question. So the labor problem, but first started because it wasn't intended this way, but it was basically paid to stay home, which hit people. That wasn't just restaurants. That was everybody. So now that that has ended, is there still a labor problem? Is there, if that is gone, and I don't know if it is there an initiative or enthusiasm problem?
So that was the major topic of season three. So like season one was, you know, pre-COVID. Season two was dealing with COVID and like, how did you survive? And season three, the question was, how is labor going? What is up with you and the shortages? And I got a mix of answers. Like some people were like, oh, no, we've had the same great employees and we might have fewer of them. It went everywhere from we have fewer than we used to have, but we still have like the majority of all our employees to, yeah, we can't seem to keep anybody or like no one wants to work, but also we don't need as many people because they're not doing as much business as they were.
Right.
So that was kind of the middle ground of it. But for the most part, all the restaurants I went to were doing fine with their labor. It was, you know, a little harder to get employees. Good employees, which just confuses the shit out of me because like waiting tables is one of the highest paid jobs you can have as long as there's people coming into the restaurant to eat. Right. So to have, if there's not enough people coming in, why do you need so many servers? And if you're a server, why would you not want to go back to work to be a server? What are you going to do? Go work for $15 an hour at a gas station? Like, if the gas station's even going to pay you $15 an hour? So, and cooks is a whole nother story. For my entire career, I have been mind boggled by how screwed cooks are, because their job, they're not dealing with people. But again, like cooking, I've just the organization of it, particularly like with on a busy Saturday night, is insane. You know, they sweat. It is hot in the kitchen and they're getting paid, you know, minimum wage sometimes. And, you know, your server who's just all drunk and drugged up, you know, just waiting on people is making $30 an hour. And, you know, granted, they're dealing with people, but the disproportionate financial aspect of the actual amount of work that you have to do and the time that you're putting in from back of the house to front of the house has always been majorly like skewed. So again, just another reason to respect those line cooks, because, you know, they put up with a lot of shit and make not as near as much as that bartender or that server's making. And it's just as hard. And so I think the future, and that's why it's harder to get front of the house or back of the house people. For the majority, the people who are looking for help, it is the kitchen. It's the hourly waged employees that are the harder ones to hold and maintain, because, you know, it's a hard job. And if you're not going to pay them well, they're not going to stick around and do that bullshit. So finding a way to balance the hierarchy, I guess, within a restaurant is probably without also hurting the servers. You can't just start, you know, take service tips and start splitting them with the whole restaurant. But if you took that hourly wage that the back of the house is getting. And so there's a restaurant in Athens, Ohio called, and a lot of restaurants are doing this around the country, like in Oregon and stuff, where they've taken away tipping and they've included 20% into the price point of everything. And so every employee gets paid the same amount of money, whether you're the front of the house, back of the house, a bartender, a line cook, a dishwasher, everyone's getting paid the same. And they're all splitting that 20% of the sales divided amongst all the employees every day. And everybody rotates positions, right? So the bartender's not always a bartender. Sometimes it's a server. The server also has to be a cook sometimes. And so they will rotate around the restaurant so that everybody knows what everybody else's job is, so you can have respect for everybody else and you don't have those fights between the front of the house and the back of the house where, you know, it gets messy sometimes because people just don't understand the pressures that each other are under, you know? And that concept, it works really well. Like, everybody who works at that place has been there forever. They're all actual part owners. If you work there for long enough, you can apply to be an owner and you get profit sharing on top of all of that. And so it's almost like a commune style restaurant called Costa Nueva in Athens, Ohio. But the same concepts happen in Oregon and other places around the country, which is a very interesting way to look at it. And so anybody who does tip on top of that, there's usually a charity of the month. So all those tips will then go to the charity of the month. And it just keeps, you know, the employees happy all around the entire establishment. So who knows? Maybe that'll be a thing.
Well, one of the reasons I chose cooking was I didn't want to see people. So I understood what was the case going in, and I was fine with that. It was much easier to not have to... Cooks afford the luxury of not having to smile, not having to perpetually be on, whereas the server... I've seen servers who break character, we'll call it that. It's kind of like a role. You have to be the smiling, shining, happy, agreeable, docile face of the company all the time you're on the floor. And most cooks don't want that. So it's an acceptable, I mean, it's voluntary. Nobody coerced a cook to go cook.
So, no, and usually cooks who like, want to cook. It's their passion, right? They want to learn. They're there to learn. They're there to grow, right? Was that your experience? Were you there to learn and to grow? And
yes,
to...
that's exactly. I mean, I had, and I achieved mostly the things I set out to do, which was to be what I thought a chef was. And I got pretty close to that, which meant, and cooking is really the last part of it. but working, so butchering, sauce making, pastry, baking. I mean, all the things. So think of like a, what would Paul Bocuse say a chef needs to know? And that was my standard. And if you can't do, I'm not saying you need to be the pastry chef, but when the pastry chef calls out, you need to fill in and do that job. And if you can do those jobs, when all those people call out, including busting suds, then.
And you're willing to work those long hours for like not that great a pay.
Pay wasn't important. I mean, because the pay wasn't the reason. The reason was put the knowledge in the fingertips.
Right. And I think that's that the problem that a lot of restaurants are having when it comes to hiring or the employment shortage is that, you know, those people really weren't that passionate about cooking to begin with. It was just a job. Right. And
that is probably those
people who are passionate to work for that wage. You know, they're farther and fewer between nowadays, I suppose, because, you know, if you're just the line cook, you don't get that much respect in your standard restaurant or at a corporate restaurant or, you know, you're doing the routine. So if you're passionate, you're looking for somebody who can teach you. You're looking to be, you know, a Padawan.
Yeah, kind of.
To someone. So you need a good owner or a good chef, a good leader, a good teacher to work under, right? And to enjoy that environment, to feel like you're learning. And so a lot of people are going out who maybe have passion and are working in places where, you know, they're not getting inspired. They have no responsibility. They're basically just treated like a robot to come in and do their job and, you know, get yelled at by some servers and sweat and cut themselves and burn themselves.
and at the Applebee's and the Fries and the Bennigan's, which doesn't exist, and Chili's, that's probably the case. It's probably since there isn't an expectation of creativity. So there isn't a lot of expectation that the person is going to be invested in doing that cooking job. I mean, it's basically, this is kind of demeaning, but it's intended to be demeaning. It's kind of piecework. It's like working at Texas Instruments and building a calculator. You're not expected to invent a new resistor to make the calculator function better or do more things. And I don't know what's the first thing about making a calculator, but if the young cook is going to say, and I'll pick two of the top, say you're going to go to Thomas Keller, you're going to go work for Danielle. Your first motivation isn't cash. Your first motivation is, what can these guys teach me? Because what Daniel knows and what Keller knows is vast.
Right.
And if you spend a couple of years in a place like that, you will be financially remunerated for the knowledge you've acquired. But it doesn't just happen by walking in the door saying, I work for Daniel. It's like, okay, so what? So there's, and for the cook and for the businesses who are, and actually there's another one, Sizzler. Sizzler here, it's been.
You still have a Sizzler?
No.
Oh.
For the last 2 years, the sign reads temporarily closed. And also now there's a big banner on the front that says for lease. So no, that's a COVID. I don't know if it's a tragedy, but there are people who worked there who don't work there now. So on some level, it is a tragedy. There is an actual impact to human families in this town because I'm sure they got a job somewhere else, but they had a job there and now they don't.
Ponderosa. I think they're gone. Is Ponderosa gone too?
I don't know. We don't have one of those here. Sizzler, we have an Applebee's. Sizzler's gone.
I mean, a lot of stuff got trimmed corporately. Tons of restaurants.
KFC and Wendy's and McDonald's and Burger King and Taco Bell. But
because there was a lot of fast food places I even forgot that existed. There was on a list of like corporate cuts, right? Like Robin's gone.
Wait, really?
It was supposed to be. It was supposed to get corporately cut, right? Like, so corporate just started cutting all their little side fast food joints and shit. Mm. That just that were just out there. Like, I'm amazed that Arby's is still around. I cannot figure out how in the hell Arby's is still in existence, because every Arby's I ever drive by, there's no one there. I don't know who's eating the meats, but
there's
like
one here when they're busy.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have one here. Never anybody there.
Hmm.
Nobody ever.
Well,
I don't know.
That's season four. How do the fast foods businesses stay here? What's going on?
Our Dairy Queen just closed. Like,
really?
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah. I like their burger too. It was flame grilled. Take that, Burger King. they were the original flame grilled.
Yeah. In season three, as you're talking about the labor problem, and maybe when you were shooting, it wasn't really much of an issue, but did you have supply chain problems as well? Were people discussing, you know, I really can't, or price increases because of a supply chain problem?
So the majority of places that I go to are usually farm to tabled, very local oriented, very seasonal. So for the most part, I spoke to a lot of people who just like it didn't really matter to them because they were making whatever was available to begin with.
Right.
So it didn't, you know, they weren't ordering, you know, tons of stuff from Sysco. So when Sysco was out, they didn't have it. You know what I mean? They were ordering, getting stuff from their local farms, and, you know, their steak got to run around and play with its friends before it was eaten. Right. So, and I try, that's, you know, that's, those are really the only places I will go for the show.
Right.
Is because that's why they survive. That's why their locals support them. That's why they're community based, is because they are community based. You know, everything that they're doing, they're trying to do within their own community, or at least as close as possible. You know, I went to a place called Ronan Farms in Bryan, Texas, where they actually started their farm first. It was called Ronan Farms, and then they opened a restaurant called Ronan. And 90% of everything that you will eat in that restaurant is directly from their farm. So from their farm to their table. And the only thing that they really picked up was they would go, the wife drives every Monday to Houston to pick up their fish. So the only thing in that restaurant that is not from their farm was the fish, which is really difficult to do. First, you have to have a farm and a restaurant.
Right.
But that's the exemplary example of, I think, what a restaurant really should be, is, you know, is everything coming from the community itself instills that sense of camaraderie around the restaurant, which is almost a guarantee for survival. You know, no matter what happens, you know, in the larger state of the world, as long as there's still that farm near you, or your supplier near to you, that you're going to be okay. You know, but if you have to rely on a larger world supply chain, and you have to have, you know, blood oranges for dessert you've had on the menu for years, and you can't get the blood oranges, and people are like, come directly only for your stupid cheesecake, when they can't get it.
Well, the blood oranges are going to have a lot to say about that, because they are not a year-round product.
No,
not like asparagus. You can get asparagus any time of the year. Blood oranges, they don't play that way. But and for listener, well, they're ending soon, but man, are they good.
Vampire's favorite orange.
Yes, indeed. So I would imagine, and I think part of the community thing would be that so how long does an episode take generally to shoot? A week, a couple days?
No, one day.
So it's quick.
We'll film the whole episode one day. So usually, you know, so they're independent chef-owned restaurants. So for the most part, they'll either open at 5 o'clock, and they'll be closed on like a Monday, right? So we'll go in the daytime and hang out and cook all the food and do the interviews and all that stuff. And then they'll open, and the camera crew will stick around and, you know, film the service and get all the inserts. And somewhere in that time, someone will have driven around town and got, you know, footage of the town and flies running around and all that. So shooting one episode's pretty quick to shoot. Post-production takes longer than
I was going to ask, because I mean, the listener does, may not care, but I'm just interested for myself, because I do this, so it's just audio, and so I play with the video now and again. So I'm just thinking, so if you have a day of shoot, how long does it take to edit that together into 28 minutes of show?
So season 2 is 45 minutes to an hour per episode. Season 3 will be about the same. And I do everything. So I literally, from as soon as we get off the road, where I have zero responsibility besides Rashawn get in front of the camera and do what we say, then I come home, and it takes, you know, shit, probably about 8 months. So about a month of full-on, you know, full-time work per episode to get it finished when it gets back. At least
it hurts my eyes and my brain to think about putting all that together. It's just, man.
Oh, that cutting it. See it. You got to cut it all together, and then you have to sound design it, which is, you know, pain in the ass. You got to color it, pain in the ass. You got to make all those fancy titles and graphics and music. Yeah, you still got to pick all the music. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
The same. Your same response to the cook managing a station on a Saturday night is exactly how I feel about trying to get all of this digital content into one space and pulling it. It's just, it's too much. it's not my skill level.
I just finished organizing each episode's project for season 3. So they are currently all, the sound is synced, the string out's there. So everything that, you know, the major plot points of the show are all laid out and just waiting to be gone through, edited, cut, rearranged, and begun the actual process of putting the dish together.
Well phrased. I like that. Appreciate that. Well done.
Well, thank you, sir. I got a fun story for you. We were talking about, you know, being a student at work, I suppose. I didn't do the restaurant, but I talked to an owner, who was recommended to me, and he's not a chef, but he owned the restaurant, and the chef had recently, he went away. And so, but he had all these talented cooks. So I asked him, well then who's the chef? Are you going to have another chef? And he said, no, that, because they're so seasonal, that he made a family of chefs. So it was like 5 chefs working in this restaurant. So the term too many cooks in the kitchen does not apply to this place, because what they would do now is for the menu, they would all sit down as a group of chefs, discuss what they were going to do for the season. And they would each kind of, you know, come up with their own dish, and each dish would go on the menu. And that's what they did seasonally. Now that's what they do now seasonally, is they go and, you know, as a collaborative, come up with the menu, and that's what's served, you know, for springtime. And they, you know, summer comes around, they all sit down and do it again. So it's more of a collaborative chef effort as opposed to just one head chef. It was a bunch of minds working together to try to make, you know, a seasonal menu every season, which I thought was really cool. He never got back to me, so we didn't go there.
No, that was in Texas.
That was in Texas, yeah.
Well, that's too bad. I won't ask you the name.
Collaborative chef. I don't remember. I'd have to go in my emails and figure it out.
Well, you know, if there's not, voluntary action is perfectly fine. I mean, if it works.
But they all felt important, right? They all felt like they're part of the restaurant. They're not just the line cook. They're not just the salad prep. They're not, you know, they're all equal in their creativity and their passion to add whatever they can bring to the table for that restaurant, which, you know, is empowering, I think, to those people.
It can be.
And probably a good way to keep your employees.
Well,
as long as they're all getting along, right?
Well, as long as they're all getting along, and I mean, no one has perfect knowledge, so there's no way to know where this can go wrong. And certainly this is not perfect. There, I'm sure they have challenges that they have to deal with.
Like, yeah, and he Frank just must started have
two
it.
Dishes and I only get one. So
I don't know how it's going because he just started it.
Well, that's all right. But I mean, it's not a bad idea.
No, I mean, makes you feel everybody wants to be part of something. You know, every restaurants and the people who work there, for the most part, it's all very family. This is my family. You know, this isn't my employees. These aren't my coworkers. This is my family, you know, and that family, the real feeling, because they do things together. You know, restaurant people do stuff together. They have holidays together. They go out for dinners together. Their families hang out together, right? Like, it's, you know, it really, if you're at a place long enough, that becomes your family. And I think at most, I don't know about corporate, you know, like working in business, that you walk into your accounting office, you know, and you're, you know, like, are these your family? Are these the people you hang out with on the weekends? I don't know. I'm not an accountant. But in restaurants, that's damn sure the way it is for a lot of people, right? Like,
I had I worked at a private club in Tallahassee, 80, 90 hours a week during, it was in, so Tallahassee is the capital city, and it was very, very near the capital itself. So we got just pounded during legislative session. And during session, I saw my chef three times as much on any given day as his actual for real wife and family did. And she ended up getting real bitter about that. And I mean, in she can say, I understand that this is the job. You have to go to work because you're the chef of the restaurant, you're the chef of the club, 9 dining rooms, and
you got 60 hours at least to put in. So
yeah, so she would joke meanly, but meant it, that you're going to go see your other wife, Dan, or your other husband, Dan. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, see this nice house you're living in? The reason you get to have this house and the reason we get a new kitchen is because I'm going to this job. So it's there's truth. I'm not an accountant, so I don't know the answer either. Do you get to work early and stay late to hang out with the people who are your accountant chums? Maybe so. I don't know.
I don't know either. But
in that one day of filming, have you found, and maybe not with everybody, but are there relationships you've built where you've become kind of this adopted part of the family, where you're still, after season one, people still contacting
you? Oh, yeah.
You contacting them? Is there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, social media helps a lot because, you know, after the season's out, there's, you know, a million different clips of the show that go out across all platforms, and everybody gets tagged in it. And so, you know, you start sharing more stuff with those people. They're now on your radar. So, like, they post something, you share it, you know, okay. You post something, they're paying attention. So, no, like, I mean, I've cried. Like, so Friendship Coffee Company episode of season two, just these lovely ladies who run this coffee shop, and it was a reverse day because they're open in the morning and close at like 3. So we actually got there in the morning and spent all day with them before we even sat down to do the interviews or cook the food or anything like that. And so we, you know, really, you know, just got super chummy with these awesome ladies. And by the end of the episode, shit, the one of the owners had cried in the beginning because her brother had passed away.
Oh.
And he was the coffee guy. He was their inspiration. And at the end of the episode, I'm like thanking them. And I just started fucking crying. Like, I don't know why I'm crying, but these ladies are amazing. Right. And so no, you do become very close in just one day, you know, of walking in and be like, oh, hey, what's up? Like, I've never met you in person. I've talked to you on the phone maybe a couple times. And here we are, and so walking into your place with crew and lights and like, what's up? And it always starts off a little like, you know, like when you were a kid and you went to go hang out with your friends and it would take you like an hour to like warm up before you really started playing. Or podcasting, even sometimes at the beginning of a podcast, it seems you're very just like trying to feel each other. But by the end, everyone's just laughing and having a great time, like your best friends, all, you know. And it's like that, you know, like anything, when you have an experience with somebody, it bonds you. You know, and yeah, and I haven't met a chef that I didn't like yet.
Yeah. And it's probably true in lots of fields, but because this is the one that I'm the most familiar with, there are, and it's not limited to cooking people, but there are people in this industry you meet where it's inexplicable that it's as if you had a past life relationship. You know, you just, it's weird. And people who have never experienced it in any field, they have this, they kind of look at you and turn their head and step back a little bit. Like, it's kind of weird to say that I met somebody I already know. It's like, what are you talking about? And you
find that as you get older, do you notice that as you get older, you have that experience more often? Or I've recently had this. Okay. Well, when you're in high school, you have a bunch of friends and half of them are shitty, right? But you're still friends with them because you kind of have to be. And as you get older, you start cutting away the fat, you know, and your years pass. And recently I've had a lot of people from high school that I just hadn't talked to in 20 years, you know, who were my good friends. I just hadn't talked to them in 20 years, like reconnecting, like a lot of them over the past year. And just like, oh my God, how have I not talked to you in 20 years? That's like, man, we're buds, dude. Like we're brothers from another mother. Like, you know, all of many, many of them. And when you reconnect after that much time, you can see, hindsight 2020, that like there was that connection. That connection still exists, even though years have passed. It's like, you know, it's last week we were just, you know, riding our bikes.
Right.
And so it's more noticeable the older you get, the possible, you know, connect your soul group, if you will.
That's good.
Being more recognized in your life.
It's a good phrase.
That's right.
All right. Well, you might be in the right medium.
Let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
I want to move to, this is a kind of a short answer part of the show. You are not obligated to answer short, but it's the intent, and you can elaborate as much as you wish. Of the five flavors, bitter, salty, sour, sweet, or umami, which one is your favorite?
Probably salty sweet.
What's your favorite food?
Oh, my favorite food? Probably pizza. Still to this day, I mean, bread, cheese, and sauce, man. Hot, delicious, gooey bread, cheese, and sauce. How do you go wrong?
What's your least favorite food?
Olives.
What's your favorite sound?
Laughter.
What sound do you hate?
Shrieking.
What gets you excited?
This prospect of the future.
What turns you off?
Shitty people.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Anything sugar.
Like the chocolate cake and chopsticks.
Anything sugar. I try not to eat sugar. Sugar is so bad for you. But God damn it.
Tastes good.
Yeah, it's so good.
Everything that's
actually really delicious is not good for you. The sad part. Anything that has so much flavor that it's, and that's how we live in America. Like everything we have is so much flavor, right? Whether it's just faked by salt and sugar or not. It's still an overwhelming amount of flavor. So if we try to eat like a normal grain vegetable, you know, maybe a little bit of fucking meat broth meal, it doesn't do it for us. And we're spoiled. So I think that's half of our nutritional problem in America, is that we're just overly inundated and spoiled by sugar and salt. And we can't appreciate just the natural flavor of a raw piece, like a raw snap pea off a vine. You know what I mean?
Processed food. That's your problem.
Yeah. Because a snap pea is fucking delicious, right?
You're maligning processed food, and you should malign processed food. It deserves to be beat up a lot.
All right. So the lady that from Friendship Coffee Company just messaged me.
Really?
And asked me if I could stop by and talk to her about something.
Well,
so, yeah, we do.
Absolutely. That's awesome. That's kind of funny how that worked out. How can people follow your work? And that's a trick question, because you have more links to stuff than anybody I've ever seen. So.
You can follow Beyond the Check everywhere at Beyond the Check. There might be an underscore. It doesn't matter. Just Google Beyond the Check. And you can follow Rashaan Parker, R-E-Y-S-H-A-N Parker, at all places. Just Google Rashaan Parker.
You have a preferred social media platform, because I can put a link to that one on today's show notes page.
Oh, let's push the Instagram. Push the Instagram and the Facebook. Okay. Beyond the Check. They're the same. Just Beyond the Check, Instagram and Facebook.
Okay, and I'll put the Beyond the Check. You have a beyondthecheck.com, right?
No, it's there's independentlasagna.com from Sasha. Okay. But
I will put that on the show notes page so people can go find your website. And
my Popple.me is the easiest, because it's just popple.me.co.
This is a new one.
P-O-P-L-E. Or I'm sorry. popple.me.co / Beyond the Check. It's my business card.
Okay. And
all the links for everything.
Yeah, you send me that. That will be the easiest way, because it's already all there.
I don't even use my website anymore since I got the Popple. Like, I fucking love my Popple.
So you mentioned Amazon, and you mentioned another
2BTV
provider. What was the name of that?
That's Fox's free streaming service. TUBI, Fox's 2BTV.
That explains all the Fox shows on it. No, then I don't know why I didn't put that together, but okay.
It's 100% free TV. I wish the Tubi would give me a dollar every time I said that, but they don't.
Well, way to go, affiliate program. Give them a good idea. All right, Rashaan. Well, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Dan, awesome hanging out, man. We'll,
me too.
If we don't do it again this life, we'll definitely do it again next life.
Well, we shall, because as you are a dog fellow, and I am a dog person also. So,
I have two very, very adorable fur babies.
Well, mine's around here someplace, but the viewer can't see that. I can see your leashes behind you. So,
there's one just in my lap there.
Oh, man, cozy.
The other one's in the window.
That's all right. Very good. All right. Well, have a great afternoon, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Awesome, Dan. Cheers. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Rashaan. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add the Popple.me link to Rashaan's digital business card, and that has a lot of ways to follow and contact him. I'll also add a link to the Amazon page for the show Beyond the Check, and the Tubi TV link, as well as some of his social media links. I mentioned Anchor.fm at the top of the show. If you think a podcast is for you, but also think you have no idea where to find guests, use Podmatch. Podmatch finds guests for podcasters and podcasters for guests. Rashaan reached out to me with Podmatch. Use my link, culinarylibertarian.com/podmatch, to find guests for your podcast. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Please support the podcast at culinarylibertarian.com/support. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.